Sister Tebogo and Alan, let's check how many members have joined in so that we can determine the quorum. It's myself, Honorable Dion George, Honorable Shwambu,
Chair, there's Mr. Skosana and Voter Vessels as well.
Mr. Skosana is here, Honorable Vessels. So we are five.
Five, Chair, we need one more.
Okay. We'll wait for a minute.
Chairman, it's Jordan speaking. I'm here as well. I just had to rename my account because my wife also uses this account, so she changes the name to her and then I forget to change it back.
Okay. So we are six. We can start with the public and with the meeting because this afternoon there's also a plenary of the NA, so that we allow people to prepare for that plenary. You are welcome, honorable members. My video is not doing well because of the location of where I am. Honorable members, you are welcome. Also welcome officials of Parliament. Welcome stakeholders who are here to make oral submissions. Of course, also welcome those who have made written submissions. The meeting is officially open. Are there apologies?
Chair, I've received no apologies.
No apologies received. Last week, when we adopted the report on the Auditing Professions Amendment Bill, I'm told that we made an omission of not adopting the bill itself. So I requested that the first item be adopting the bill. Sister Tebogo, is it you or will explain as to what is supposed to be done before I call on members to adopt the bill?
The members need to look at the A list and then adopt the amended bill that was sent through by Treasury yesterday, looking at the amendments that they had requested last week.
Do you have them in the site that you can write them on the screen?
Yes, I think Alan will do so, and then we'll go through the bill clause by clause.
Do we have to go clause by clause? Is it not? Is it how many clauses are we amending in that bill?
I think Advocate
Jenkins. You can proceed.
There are not a lot of amendments, but I think Advocate Jenkins can advise if we just concentrate on the list only or go through the amendments in the bill itself.
Okay, quickly, Advocate Jenkins, what are we supposed to do? Because this is what we should have done last
question. Yes, we adopt the bill. What we need is we need to go through the clauses of the bill, adopt them. We do need to go at least page by page, especially where we've made amendments, Chairperson. The committee needs to look at them and say we've adopted that clause as is, or we've adopted the amended clause, and then move on. That's the system that we do to adopt the bill. Otherwise, we're going to get some procedural challenge, Chairperson. Thank you.
Okay, let's be guided as to which clauses we are supposed to look at and adopt. Alan, quickly flight the report or the bill on the screen and we'll be guided as to which clauses that are we supposed to look at. Okay. Which clause do we start with? We have to start from 2 until the last. Okay. Clause 2, agreed. Honorable Mayor. Agreed. Let's go to clause 3. Clause 3, agreed.
Agreed.
Agreed. Next clause. Clause 4, agreed.
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 Agreed. New clauses. Clause amendment section 5. Amending section 14 of the Principal Act. Agreed.
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 Agreed. 6. Section 19 of the Principal Act is hereby amended. There is an amendment. Agreed?
Agreed.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. Clause 5. There it is on the screen. Agreed?
Agreed.
Agreed. Clause 6. Pull it
agreed.
Agreed. Clause 7. Disciplinary committee. Agreed?
Agreed.
Agreed,
yeah. Okay. New clauses. Amendment of section 36 of Act 26 of 205 as substituted by section 4 of Act 2 of 2015. 10. Section 36 of the Act is hereby amended as follows. There is a long paragraph. Agreed?
Agreed.
Agreed.
Clause 8, page 5, after line 5, to insert by the deletion of paragraph B of section 2.
Agreed.
Agreed. Agreed.
Okay. New clauses. Amendment section 39 of Act 26 of 205, as substituted by section 7 of Act 2 of 2015, 12. Section 39 of the Act is hereby amended and substituted by the following subsection. Agreed?
Agreed.
Agreed.
Agreed. 13. New clauses on page 5 from line 23 to omit subsection and to substitute sections on page 5 after line 27 to insert that paragraph. Agreed?
Agreed.
Agreed.
There is clause 10 on page 5 from line 36 to omit subsection 1A and to substitute with that paragraph. Agreed?
Agreed.
Agreed, sir.
Agreed. Clause 11, insertion of section 48A to 48B in Act 26 of 205. Agreed?
Agreed.
Powers of search and seizure. Those are the powers of search and seizure. Agreed. And then clause 12, on page 9, in line 13, after the plea insert or amended plea, then 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Agreed.
Clause agreed. 12.
Agreed.
Agreed. Clause 12. The next clause 14, go back a bit. On page 11, from line 48, to omit subsection 1 and to substitute with that paragraph. Agreed?
Agreed.
Agreed.
The next clause 15, page 12, line 39, to omit just and to substitute sufficient. Agreed?
Agreed.
Agreed.
Clause 16, insertion of section 57A in Act 26 of 205. Agreed.
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 Agreed. The next clause. New clauses. That the following be a new clause to follow clause 16. Amendment of arrangement of sections of Act 26 of 205. 22, and that's the those are sub-paragraphs. agreed.
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 The long title on page 2 in the 7th line, to omit to provide for a duty to disclose information, the close quote. On page 2, from the 9th line, to omit of personal and to substitute and sharing of. Agreed?
Agreed.
Agreed.
Agreed. And then what next? We are done, I hope. Okay. Can somebody move for the adoption of the bill as a whole?
I so move.
Honorable Abrams move. Honorable Mavila, you second?
I second, yes.
Okay.
Chairperson, could you note that the DEA would reserve its position?
Okay, we'll note that, Dr. George.
Thank you.
And Chair, we are not voting for, and we'll give the reasons when we debate it earlier.
Okay, thanks, Honorable Shibambo. Okay, let's move to the item, the purpose of the meeting today. The purpose is to conduct public hearings on the South African Reserve Bank Amendment Bill, B26 of 2018. Stakeholders, what we are going to do, I will allow you 15 minutes to make a presentation, and then later we are going to take a discussion, comments and clarity seeking questions. Let me find out from the secretary for now, those that will be making oral submissions will be Business Leadership SA, ANC Youth League Crisis Committee, Institute of Race Relations, and National Treasury. Then we take a discussion. Then we have got lots of written submissions. If you look at the program, they are listed below those written submissions. And what is going to happen after today's session, we'll create another session where the legal division will come and make responses. Because procedural, if the bill comes from a department, it is the department that is allocated space and time to make responses. After those responses, is then that we are going to find another day where we are going to process the report, which will be submitted to the NA. I got a message from Honorable Shibambo that when the time comes for responses, which will be a session for another day, it won't be today, they would like to be given an opportunity to make an input. We have noted that request, Honorable Shibambo. And as I have explained, that will be another session. Today, we are taking submissions from the public. Okay. Alan and Tebuko, the first one is Business Leadership South Africa. Is it so?
That's correct, Chair. If the person from BLSA can just identify themselves.
Okay. BLSA, are you connected?
Yes, good morning, Chair. It's me, it's Nonhla Nhlamshaba from Business Leadership South Africa.
Okay. Nonhla, you are welcome. You have got 15 minutes, so it's from now 9:15 until 9:30 for you to make the presentation.
Thank you, Chair.
Over to you.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning to all colleagues present on the call. I've mentioned before, by way of introduction, my name is Nonhla Nhlamshaba, and I am presenting on behalf of Business Leadership South Africa in my capacity as the Policy and Legislation Coordinator. Business Leadership South Africa, as an independent organization representing many of South Africa's largest companies, welcome the opportunity to make submissions on the bill. Given the tight deadlines on the submissions of the bill, we have kept our submissions high level and fairly short. As BLSA and as mandated by our members, BLSA does not support the proposed bill. We We are of the view that the bill introduces unnecessary risk to the country, to sustainable jobs-intensive employment growth, and the cost of funding for businesses, and is also unconstitutional. Our two main concerns with the bill are as follows. The first one being that changing the governance structure and thus nationalizing the South African Reserve Bank will negatively affect the Reserve Bank's credibility, South Africa's monetary policy approach, and its current standing in the world. We believe that this is a risky move with no meaningful benefit. The risk is exacerbated by the creeping state control and failure that we are experiencing as a country. Additionally, in light of the Minister of Finance recently announcing steps to make cross-border business easier, which includes relaxing rules around inward listings, loop structures, and foreign corporate borrowing, as well as the National Treasury announcing that it was exploring the listing of foreign denominated assets on local exchanges, which will both ultimately attract inward investment and position the country as an African financial hub. We perceive this as a move that may be seen as going in the opposite direction. Furthermore, we believe that the committee should be aware of how important the institutional quality of the state is for foreign direct investment. Financial markets and ultimately through the yield curve into businesses' ability and cost of funding. Both perceived and actual central bank independence is a core component of many global indices and ratings related to emerging markets like South Africa, which investors look at. Given the degradation over the years of state capture in our state's institutional strength, the South African Reserve Bank is at present, to a large degree on its own, holding up these global ratings for South Africa. We must also recognize that the Reserve Bank operates in a set of global central bank, monetary policy, and financial sector regulatory norms, which allow South Africa easy access to the global financial sector and cross-border financing. Tampering with these could have disastrous consequences. Our second and final issue is with the bill is our legal concerns with the proposed bill. The Reserve Bank, the shares of the Reserve Bank are a form of incorporeal property. Shareholders have in the past subscribed for shares and have contributed to the capitalization of the Reserve Bank. Section 22 of the South African Reserve Bank Act contemplates that shares in the Reserve Bank can be bought and sold, and Section 24, Subsection E, contemplates the payment of dividends to shareholders. Subsequently, shares in the Reserve Bank may have a value in the market. Repealing Section 22 of the South African Reserve Bank in its entirety would effectively amount to an expropriation without compensation of the shares in the South African Reserve Bank. In our view, this expropriation would be unconstitutional for want of compliance with Section 25, Subsection 2B of the Constitution of South Africa. In closing, and to recap, the LSA, mandated by our members, does not support the proposed bill, as we are of the view that the bill introduces unnecessary risk to the country and is also unconstitutional. Thank you, Chair, for allowing us to share our submissions in this regard. At BLSA, we are available to engage further on this bill and to find a suitable and sustainable solution to the issues raised. Thank you.
Pleasure, no transfer from BLSA. Thanks for the presentation. ANC Youth League Crisis Committee, over to you from now, 20 past until 25 to 10. You have got 15 minutes.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson of the committee. My name is Ngakosala Mulela. I will be representing the ANC Youth League Crisis Committee, which is an organ of members of the ANC Youth League, given the crisis that we might be forget that. That is not for the, for today. Today, as you all know, Honorable members, the African National Congress Youth League in the in 2011, passed a resolution and a clarion call to the country on economic freedom in our lifetime. Among the resolutions we have taken in that conference was that we must deal away with the partial ownership, private ownership of the South African Reserve Bank by shareholders. This is because, as you will know, this is a serious anomaly. And the allegation this is in line with international standards is very false and does not hold water. In the entire world, honorable members, there are only 8 reserve banks that are partially owned privately. On our African soil is ourselves and Nigeria. We got Switzerland and others. But the trend is that central banks are wholly owned by the state in the similar manner that the National Defense Force, National Intelligence Agency Services, and all other agencies and parastatals that protect the welfare and well-being of our people are owned by the state. So we see that as a serious anomaly. Second, we think that it is very wrong for the state to have equal footing in terms of appointment of the directorship of the Reserve Bank with private shareholders. It is very wrong. We think it is very wrong because, as you all know, it is normal that the private individuals represent their interest and that the aim of business is business. So it is very clear that even these private shareholders have their individual business interest to look after. Now, with an institution like the South African Reserve Bank, an institution that is in charge of our fiscal and monetary policy, an institution that decides on whether to encourage saving or consumption through interest rates, an institution that sets the law for investment in the country and for movement of financial resources in and out of the country, cannot have private business influence. To us, this undermines our sovereignty as a country. It is our sovereignty auctioned to the highest bidder, those who have sufficient resources. Secondly, the private shares in the Reserve Bank are not a matter of today. So the further allegation that these are just done to recapacitate and recapitalize the bank is false. As you will remember, the South African Reserve Bank was launched in 2002. This was preceded by a very big meeting of captains of mines, as particular who have interest in gold mining. It is those captains of mines who resolved that we must actually have a central currency. And from that beginning, the South African Reserve Bank was never wholly owned by the state. So this does not come as something that is amazing. Because the captains of industry had to protect their interest. And we are now saying that the interest of the people of the country cannot be put underneath private business interest of individuals. We are thus proposing as follows, that the amendment to the Act be passed by Parliament. And that is, such amendment must have an intention of transferring, as President Ramaphosa always rhetoric, and any other politician always rhetoric when they want to vote, that the following must are proposed amendments and in line with transferring the ownership of the bank to the full ownership of the state. And we are proposing that every definition that has to do with the shareholder in the Primary Act, Act number 90 of 1989, be wholly deleted. These are definitions that have been brought forward by Honorable Julius Malema in the private members bill that is we are today discussing. So those definitions, as you see them, as you will see them in the submission, is the definition of a shareholder. Such a definition has no bearing in, must be removed because it will not have any bearing in the act. Those associate relative and elected directors as proposed by Honorable Malema surely be removed from the act, from the definition section 1 of the act, because they have all to do with nothing else but private shareholdership of the Reserve Bank. We're proposing that section 4 of the South African Reserve Bank Act be repealed and be amended as follows. Amended as follows. That in line with the international standards and practices, here business people have been talking about international practices and standards. 7 directors be appointed by the president through public nomination process. So we are proposing there that we delete that sentence that used to say the bank shall be governed by 14 directors. We are proposing that this must read, if you check our written submission, not the PowerPoint one. If you check our web submission that we have made to you, we are saying that in line with the international practices and standards, we must remove 4-7 shareholders, directors who are elected by shareholders from the Reserve Bank. And this means that the Reserve Bank will be governed by a board of 7 directors. These several other banks operate the same way, including the Federal Reserve of the United States of America. So I suppose that the international standards that people are very much obsessed with will find we will be accepted in this. We have a problem with some in the section 5. Section 1B and 1A and 1B shall not have no bearing on the act that will be adopted. Removing shareholders. So section 1A and B should be deleted, and section 5(2) be revised to exclude elected directors. Section 6 serves no purpose in the new dispensation. So is section 21 and section 30 and section 23. It is proposed that the minister be empowered to appoint audit firms and not the directors, not the board of directors. It is within this spirit that we call for support of the amendments that have been brought forward by Honorable Julius Malema. And we wanted to know, to say the following, that first, the allegation that there is unconstitutionality in this matter is false. Section 25 of the South African Constitution, which is a matter that has been many people have been protecting their private business with, actually allows expropriation in the public interest. It is in the interest of the people of South Africa to have their South African Reserve Bank wholly owned by themselves. So in this case, the Section 25 of the Constitution does not prohibit expropriation of shares or any property in the interest of the state. Now, if you were in parliament and you were sitting there, and will wish to protect the private interest of individuals, you will one day have a problem with supplying water to a far remote villages having to pass it through privately owned farmland, which is the case, which have been the case. Now, in that case, the state expropriates in the public interest a portion that they need in the public interest. It is the same with this Reserve Bank submission. Secondly, there have not been any value that has been added to the Reserve Bank, to the duties of the Reserve Bank by private share ownership. Thirdly, the allegation that the independence of the Reserve Bank will be infringed by ownership of the state is a laughable, very, very laughable allegation. This is because only eight central banks in the world are owned by, have private shareholders. Now, the allegation supposes that there are only eight independent reserve banks in the world. That is false. That cannot be true. The independence of the Reserve Bank has nothing to do with being owned by private individuals. It is, has everything to do with the policy direction of the Reserve Bank. As it stands, the government appoints the governor and three deputy governors. The implementation of the policy direction of the Reserve Bank happens there. Some of the decisions of the board are by the primary act of the South African Reserve Bank, as we are discussing here, are being transferred to the governor. And they are allowed to be transferred to the governor. The very same governor who is appointed by the state. Now, the allegation of the independence falls flat on its face. All we can say is that we call upon public representatives of our people, members of parliament, who have been elected to by South African population in general to protect the interest of the country and surely the interest of its citizens, to consider protecting those interests of the people who have elected you, members of parliament, to be in parliament, against individual business private interest of very few people who own shares in the Reserve Bank. We will not talk about the color of the skin of people who own those shares, neither will we talk about the geographic location of those people. But if you go to the Reserve Bank website, you will get such information. You will see that it is very abnormal. We will not talk about the shares not being traded in public, because in our view, those shares should not be traded, whether over the counter or in stock exchange. So, Honorable Chairperson, we are calling upon Parliament to do the right thing. And the right thing is to ensure that the South African Reserve Bank, as a collective heritage and property of our people, is transferred to the ownership of our people as a whole. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Mr. Slamlele, for representing the ANC Youth League. The next submission comes from Institute of Race Relations from now until 10 to 10. Race Relations.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Committee and representatives of other stakeholders. I hope you can hear me well.
Yes, I can hear you.
Thank you. My name is John Endres. I am the Chief of Staff at the Institute of Race Relations, and I thank you for providing my organization with the opportunity to comment on the bill. Before getting to my main argument, I would like to point out that the bill is unconstitutional as it does not provide for compensation of shareholders who would be deprived of their property by this bill. It also has not undergone a socioeconomic impact assessment as is required before new laws are adopted. And for these two reasons, it should be rejected. But furthermore, the Institute of Race Relations opposes adoption of the South African Reserve Bank Amendment Bill because it is bad for the Reserve Bank and it is bad for South Africa. And let me explain what I mean. The South African Reserve Bank has been one of the most successful and well-run public entities in South Africa. It shines like a diamond among the dross of most of our other public institutions. In 2009, the government set the Reserve Bank an inflation target band ranging from 3 to 6%. And since 2010, inflation has been kept to that band, only crossing the upper 6% threshold twice by a tiny fraction in 2014 and 2016. And the credit for the superb performance belongs to the governor of the Reserve Bank, Mr. Letsetsa Kganyago, who won the 2018 Central Banking Governor of the Year Award, and his colleagues at the bank and on the Monetary Policy Committee. They have worked with dedication, professionalism, and integrity on maintaining the value of our currency, and we owe them a debt of gratitude. And this is because failing to maintain monetary stability causes runaway inflation. And the effects of inflation are devastating for economies, affecting the poor sooner and in harsher ways than the wealthy. Although under high inflation, everybody suffers. Against this background, our position is that an institution with such a stellar track record as the South African Reserve Bank should not be meddled with lightly. Yet this is precisely what this bill seeks to do. The bill proposes to remove some of the checks and balances that exist, small though they may be, in the form of private shareholders and their limited powers. It proposes instead to give the state untrammeled control over the bank, with less oversight and greater power in the hands of fewer people. Such centralization of power is dangerous because when those few people get it wrong, the effects are felt by very many people. I believe we can also say without fear of contradiction that entities owned and controlled by the South African government very often underperform. And this is true for government departments, as well as state-owned enterprises such as Eskom, SAA, Denel, and others. And the government's track record has been far from stellar, with very few notable exceptions. So the question really arises whether giving this same government greater control over one of the nation's most vital institutions is wise. Examples from around the world and throughout history show the importance of central bank independence. And leaving aside the question of ownership for a moment, where the South African Reserve Bank is indeed an anomaly, I'd like to draw your attention to what happens when a government asserts greater control over a central bank and reduces its autonomy. And the example I choose is that of Turkey. The beginning of November 2020, so at the beginning of this month, Turkish President Erdogan fired the central bank governor and replaced him with a former finance minister, who became the fourth governor in 5 years. And President Erdogan is famously and strictly opposed to high interest rates, controversially believing that they fuel inflation. His high turnover in central bank governors is partly as a result of their not respecting his wishes. Of course, our central bank is independent, President Erdogan said in 2018. But the central bank can't take this independence and set aside the signals given by the president. So as you can see from that quote, he's trying to have his cake and eat it as well. So let's see what the effects have been of the president's interference in the central bank. In Turkey, inflation has been sitting persistently above 10% for the past 3 years. And this year alone, the Turkish government has spent $65 billion on managing its currency. And that's according to estimates by Goldman Sachs. And that included borrowing dollars from domestic banks to prop up the Turkish lira. But all these efforts have been in vain, as the Turkish currency has lost 30% of its value against the dollar since the beginning of the year. So they spent $65 billion, that money is gone, and they lost 30% of their value. And this is a result of lacking independence on the part of the central bank. So what this shows us is that managing currency stability is really an incredibly critical task that should be kept in the hands of professionals acting independently of politicians. Otherwise, the consequences can be dire and very, very expensive. Other examples that show this include Venezuela and closer to home, Zimbabwe. And this is the scenario, so the Venezuela or Zimbabwe scenario, that talk of nationalizing the Reserve Bank will evoke in the minds of investors. It will place in doubt the bank's future ability to manage currency stability, and it evokes nightmare scenarios of hyperinflation. It will make it far more difficult for South Africa to attract the investment it needs, to generate the growth it requires, to combat poverty and unemployment, and to make South Africa a prosperous and successful nation. And it is true that private ownership of central banks is rare in the world, but it is also true that nationalization is rare. So in the last 40 years, there have only been two central banks that have been nationalized, and that's Tuvalu and Austria. So this is a very unusual process that's going to draw attention to South Africa and the way it manages its banking sector. So we understand that that this risk of hyperinflation is not something that private shareholders of the bank are currently in a position to prevent, but they do act as a small corrective. They act as a warning angel sitting on the metaphorical shoulder of the Reserve Bank and the Monetary Policy Committee as they go about their business. We say that Parliament should heed the warnings of the Reserve Bank governor, of the state legal advisor, as well as prominent economists and of history, and reject this bill. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, John, from the South African Institute of Race Relations for your presentation.
Thank you.
Now, let's invite National Treasury. From now, it's quarter to 10 until 10 o'clock. Who's presenting from National Treasury?
Chair, it's Momo. I'm presenting.
Over to you, Mr. Mumuniat.
Hi, thank you, Chair. Chair, apologies. This is a slightly updated presentation. I think members just received an earlier draft, but there's no material changes to them. Chair, thank you. Next slide. Let me apologize, Chair, because the minister, I think, is at cabinet, the deputy minister, and the DG, I think, is in another committee meeting, so they're unable to attend this. So I'm here with Errol Makubela, and we've got some officials from the legal section of the Reserve Bank, Chris van der Walt and Shehnaz Mir, just to help us. I think members would know that the Reserve Bank is having a Monetary Policy Committee meeting currently. But thank you for inviting the Treasury to present, honorable members. Next slide. Chair, I think I'm not going to deal with this slide, but I think I just wanted to put up the ruling party's conference, at its 53rd conference on this matter, because that has been a big factor in this debate. Certainly not saying that other parties don't have their views and their perspectives, and I think we're conscious of that. Some parties want to go further. Some parties have very different perspectives, perhaps. But I want to just focus on the last bullet that, desirable as it is to own, for the state to be the sole shareholder, which is a practice in most countries. I mean, in a sense, what we have is just a result of our history. The point is that we are there, and to move towards 100% ownership, in the resolution, it's also recognized that, that this mustn't be done in a way that will unduly benefit private shareholder speculators, of which there are some that we are aware of. So Treasury just wanted to put forward this perspective. We're certainly not going to get into the politics and the views of political parties. This presentation, Chair, is more from a legal and technical perspective on the implications of this policy as it's outlined in the bill and what the implications are. And we'll leave the politics to the minister and deputy minister to deal with when they need to come in. Next slide. So Chair, I'm not going to go through this point. I think most people know it, that the SAAB is established in terms of Section 223 of the Constitution, and Section 224 does outline the primary objective of the SAAB to protect the value of the currency in the interest of balance and sustainable economic growth in the Republic. So it's not just a focus only on the value of the currency. You can see it has to take into account economic growth. And in pursuing that primary object, there must be regular consultation between the bank and the Minister of Finance, so that there is coordination between monetary and fiscal policy via this consultation process. Obviously, you don't dictate. It is a consultation process. Move on. Next slide. So, Chair, I guess the issue is for us, what problem is the bill trying to solve? I think it's trying to, as it states clearly, ensure ownership of the 2 million shares are all owned by the state. As I said, this is in line with the central banks of most countries. So the idea itself is not by any means a revolutionary idea. It's actually the norm. And the bill therefore changes the shareholding structure by making the state the sole shareholder, and the rights of the shareholder then is exercised by the Minister of Finance. The bill also goes a bit further in the sense that it has to make, and some of them may be consequential changes, but effectively changes the governance arrangements, including that all directors to the board are then appointed by the Minister of Finance from a list confirmed by a panel that's established in terms of the Act. The minister also appoints the auditors of the bank. So whilst the bill does not directly change the mandate and independence of the SAAB, there's no real comfort for investors that in future it will not go further, that there won't be further amendments to the bill. In fact, I know that when Honorable Shivambu made his presentation, there was some reference that this would be a first step and that there would be a change towards the mandate of the SAAB. Now, whether that's correct or not, I guess the issue is how can we give assurance that this bill will stop or future bills will stop at ownership and won't go and deal with the mandate and independence of the SAAB. Because the mere perception that this may happen in the future already sends a powerful negative signal to investors and to savers, I should add, on how monetary policy will function in the future. It does impact on the views people take on the future value of the currency. So, Chair, from that perspective, Treasury does feel that some of the key concerns is what the bill, in a sense, does not do, because it ignores the rights of shareholders as codified in the SAAB Act, and in effect sends an adverse signal to investors and savers that if there is a forced takeover of SAAB shares, it generates fears that will it stop at the SAAB? Will it extend to other financial assets, for example? It's silent on how to fund the purchase of such shares, and in fact assume that they can be simply be expropriated, perhaps that's the word, not appropriated. It does not take into account the bilateral investment treaties, which then foreign shareholders in those countries can take up. Next slide. So I guess the question for us is what problem does it really solve at this stage? Because changing the composition of ownership will not result in any material change in the current role of government in respect of the SAAB. I think contrary to any perception, the government is in full control, in a sense, on the policy issues, and the SAAB is in control of that more directly. The government can appoint, the president appoints the governors and deputy governors, and once appointed, they have full operational independence to determine monetary policy. The shareholders have absolutely no say in the policies of the staff as led by the governor and deputy governors. So whilst the bill doesn't impact on the mandate and operational independence, as I said, it will signal otherwise. Currently, the power of the board of SARB is limited to corporate governance. All other powers in terms of the SARB Act. Just to look at the status quo, there are 15 directors that are appointed. The private shareholders only have the right to appoint, through the confirmation process by the panel, 7 of the 15 directors. The 4 directors plus the 3 deputy governors and governor, making a total of 8, are appointed by government. So will there be any consequences for changing the ownership structure? Yes. Even if all shareholders were to voluntarily agree to be paid out at whatever nominal value that's offered, it will still generate fears that, as I said, that this will be a first step towards changing the mandate of the SARB. You only have to hear what people are saying. It just has to be a perception. And it also generates, as I said, fears that it will lead to more corruption or capture. Whether you agree with that or not is one thing, but those fears are there. Yes, and it will also generate fears about amongst investors about expropriation and more uncertainty on property rights beyond just the land issues that are also, as we all know, a part of the debate. Move on. Chair, so if you look at the bill itself, because it's a private member's bill, Parliament doesn't have a process where there's any socioeconomic impact study that's conducted on the bill. The impact on the economy, investment or fiscus has not been assessed, and we believe that these could be potentially very, very large. There's no assessment on whether the bill transgresses the Constitution. If it came through the cabinet process, the state law advisors have to certify that it is constitutional before it gets to the committee. And there's no assessment on whether the bill conflicts with other policy objectives and trade-offs that are involved. And in fact, some of the reforms that we want we've started doing on how you resolve bank crises and so on, all of those will in effect be affected by this bill. Next slide. Chair, I won't go into this. I think most members would know it, but the SARB Act allows for 2 million ordinary shares. The share capital can increase. Currently, the SARB does publish a shareholder index, and about 12.65% of shares are currently held by foreign nationals. Move on. And these are the sections that sort of deal with it, so I won't deal with this. It's just for the members' own information. Next slide. So, Chair, I think if you look at the current bill, as I said, it also does, I've dealt with these issues, so I won't deal with them again, but I'll just put this out, what the current Act does in Section 2242. And given our experience of the last 10 years with state-owned entities when some of them were captured, I think we would submit that the fact that any minister has the sole power to appoint all directors and the auditors, and this is an oddity from the Companies Act as well, that when you have a sole shareholder, effectively the sole shareholder appoints the auditors. I think that those provisions made it pretty easy to capture. So in a sense, the proposed amendments effectively will make it easier, I think, or much harder to protect the SARB from such risks in the future. And just given the lessons that we've learned, I think these are risks to take into account. that the fact that one minister or government itself doesn't appoint all shareholders, I think does bring in some inbuilt protection to the SAAB, which is a critical institution. Next slide. I'll just, it's a nice picture to look at. It again just separates the operations and management and role of the board. Next slide. Chair, I should add that certainly from the quote that I think in the minister's letter, just outlining the approach of the president as well on the prudency of rushing to get ownership does carry huge risks, something that the president has pointed out. Next slide. So, Chair, if you look at just to sum up our fundamental objections, government does have fundamental objections to the bill based on its constitutionality. As I've said, based on the future, its impact on future investment and on the economy and jobs, its lack of detail on funding and cost implications, its conflicts with other legislation, and the bill doesn't align with the current policy objectives and funding priorities of government. We'd have to move funds because were this bill to go through, it will have funding implications, either because a court will force us to pay, but it will be challenged. So this bill will not be uncontested, and the government will have to pick up whatever bill that emerges through that process. Next slide. And Chair, on that, our key concern is that it will cost billions. It will go beyond the nominal, the 20 million or so is small rands. But there are those that have actually seen this as a potential to have access or share of all assets, including the reserves of the country. And all of that will have to be challenged through those BIT arbitration mechanisms. And it will take years. It will cause lots of paralysis. It will cause continued uncertainty for many, many years. So even if we win and it ends up being a very low cost, the costs will have to be measured in terms of many, many years of uncertainty for all the legal processes to deal with. I won't deal with this slide. I've dealt with, some of the other proposals in the bill. Next slide. Chair, I think the issues of constitutionality have been raised in the committee that when you're dealing with expropriation of general application, there are factors to take into account, and this bill does not make any provision for compensation. So, I don't want to get into the, I'm not a lawyer, I won't get into these legalities, but we can certainly provide legal opinions and so on to this effect, should they be necessary. Next slide. As I outlined, our greatest concern is how foreign shareholders, the claims that they would have. And indeed, we are aware that there have been some shareholders. Indeed, we introduced the panel a few years ago precisely because we had a few shareholders. Yes, there are troublesome shareholders. And yes, some are there to speculate and in fact actively instigate so that to trigger the nationalization clause so that they can then lay claim to the foreign reserves of the country. I've gone through this, so I won't repeat this. So we would be exposed to significant claims. And as I said, it will take many, many years then to deal with this. Next slide. I think, Chair, we could also say that in effect, this bill could be seen to be a quasi-money bill given the implications it will have for funding. We think that this is also something to explore if it is a quasi-money bill. Then a money bill in effect, then it could only be introduced by the Minister of Finance. I think that will be a further issue of how this bill is classified that needs to be considered. Next slide. Chair, I won't go into all of this. As I said, it deals with a lot of the current approaches we have in our financial sector legislation on SIFIs. It contradicts the resolution powers of the SARB. So it does have broader implications, even around the recent reforms that we put in place after the 2008 global financial crisis to strengthen the powers of the SARB. Next slide. So to conclude, Chair, I think what we're saying is full ownership may be desirable and certainly is not a revolutionary objective. It is the norm. But given where we are, it will have huge costs and there are significant trade-offs which will impact negatively on investment and on economic growth. And any change to the bill cannot escape the context in which we are making this following the years of state capture, looting, and so on. The bill does not address many of the key concerns, including on funding and economic impact. Just to make the point that the minister so amply made in his MTBPS, we are sort of stuck in a low growth trap with great fiscal challenges. And the question does emerge, why do we want to risk slowing growth and creating even more uncertainty when we are probably at our weakest, economically speaking? The governance arrangements will be significantly weaker and weakens our defenses to protect the South from future capture. And I think for all these reasons, as the minister has outlined in his letter, the government does not support the bill and in fact will oppose it very strongly. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mumunia from National Treasury. Honorable members, now we are at the item on clarity seeking questions and discussions. Secretariat will assist me in identifying members who would like to ask questions to the stakeholders.
Chair, for now, there's Mr. Shivambu and Dr. George.
Over to you, Honorable Shivambu.
Can you hear me?
Hello,
Chair. You know, can you hear me? Can you hear me? I'm here, Chairperson. Am I clear?
Now you are clear. Maybe you can mute the video. Your sound is on and off. Okay.
No, thanks. Am I clear now though? Like, yeah, I hope I'm not on and off. I just want to make some few observations in terms of what happens. I think in the past we made an observation that, you see, National Treasury is captured by a faction that is led by the person who just presented on behalf of National Treasury now. And it thinks that it has got political power over the political principles that are elected to provide political guidance to National Treasury. That is why he comes here to say that government is opposed to the discontinuation of private ownership of the South African Reserve Bank. With the ruling party that is government now has got a resolution that the Reserve Bank's private shareholders must be removed and 100% of those shares must be transferred to the state. So I don't know on whose behalf is he talking on behalf of. Maybe we might need to organize a separate session with the political principals. If it is them who say that, perhaps we can have a serious discussion of what gets to happen. And the basis of the objection of National Treasury, it's false alarms, like false alarms which are not dissimilar from the white minority and racist false alarms that we raised when a black government was being established in the early mid 1990s. to say that, you know, you cannot have a black government, everything else will come to a standstill, will collapse. That is basically the essence of the objection on why the South African Reserve Bank cannot be transferred to the ownership of the state, because there is no sound economic and political reasons that is being given here. You can't say that the economy is going to not attract investment or not grow because the state will be full ownership of the Reserve Bank. The biggest destinations of investments in the world are countries with state-owned central banks. But here in South Africa, we've got private shareholders in the Reserve Bank. We have not been seeing any growth. We have not been seeing any investments. So it's nonsensical to could want to attribute low growth and no investments to a Reserve Bank that is owned by the state. So it's just those few things that you then begin to realize. Now, Chair, when the Reserve Bank Act was amended, there were shareholders which individually had more than 80,000, sometimes 100,000 shares. And an amendment was passed to say that we are going to take the 70,000 shares from those of you who are owning 80,000. You are only permitted to own up to 10,000 shares. None of those people even tried to claim billions of rands, which were told here in a false and misleading way that people are going to claim billions of rands if we discontinue the 10,000 components of ownership that are defining the most highest owners, the biggest owners of individual shareholders in the Reserve Bank are owning 10,000 shares individually. So where would that be coming from? So if they wanted billions, they could have gone to look for those billions when the act came into place that said that you can't own 80,000 shares and you and your family, it has to be up to 10,000 shares, which, by the way, do not have any massive financial benefits. I want to see a rational human being, a rational court of law, which would say that I know that out of owning these shares, you're going to only get 1,000 rand per year. But now because you're taking these shares that for you per year were costing 1,000 rand, I'm going to rule that you must be given billions of rands. Where will that be? Where's rationality in that? It's absolute false alarms and nonsense that is being fed here, because people want to then say that a black government cannot own a central bank when all other governments, almost all other governments in the world are owning their central banks. And you must check that even on the nine that have got private shareholders, the state has got some degree of exposure in terms of ownership of those particular banks. Okay, I think what I requested prior the meeting and what you spoke to in terms of like perhaps because we are the ones who introduced the bill, perhaps we need to be given enough time equal to what National Treasury had here to respond to the so many distortions of what the process of introducing the bill did. It is not true, Momo, that we did not conduct socioeconomic study. It is not true that there was no assessment of whether this is consistent with the Constitution. It is not true whether we didn't do any assessment in terms of what are the conflicts with other policies of government. So all those things that you are saying here are not true. It's false. And you come to want to agitate Parliament, supposedly on behalf of government, on false information. And that is wrong in a manner that it is. Chair, we will deliberate, and we have got a constitutional right, we have got a democratic right to talk about anything in South Africa, including the relative autonomy of the Reserve Bank. It is relatively autonomous now because the section in the Constitution that gives the autonomy or the independence of the Reserve Bank, section 224, says that the bank, in pursuit of its primary object, must perform its functions independently and without fear, favor, or prejudice. but there must be regular consultation between the bank and the cabinet member responsible for national financial matters. That is a relative autonomy because the constitution already says that in performing your functions, you must be in constant consultation with government. It is there in the, so, but to talk about at what scale, at what scope do we then deal with that relative autonomy? There is nowhere in this constitution where it says that members of parliament or government is not allowed to talk about this. We must talk about it. What has the Reserve Bank done for the well-being of our people? That question must be asked. What has the Reserve Bank done in terms of inclusion of our people into the economy? That question must be asked openly. And what is the relationship of the Reserve Bank to the private controllers? All of these issues must be done. But I would think that, Chair, at the end, we should be allowed to respond because we are the ones who introduced the bill. We must respond to all the false alarms that are raised, even by the Institute of Race Relations, which is opportunistically bringing Venezuela and Zimbabwe in a discussion that has got nothing to do with that in this particular context. We must dismiss the nonsensical submissions that were made by the IRR and the BLA, but we need adequate time because we are the ones who introduced the bill. And of course, when there's public submissions, we carry the right to respond to each and every aspect that is a discussion.
Okay, for now, let's focus on clarity-seeking questions. As I've said, we are going to have a session as a committee where there will be responses, the same way that we process bills that come from departments. So to date, we are asking questions to those who are submitting. Then, and when we come back in the next session, we'll create space for responses. Then after that, we are still going to engage in the draft report, which ultimately will have to be adopted to be presented in the NA. Honorable George.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to leave my video off because my connection is not stable, so I hope it's all fine. I want to ask the ANC Youth League, are you speaking on behalf of the ANC or are your inputs the opinion of the Youth League only? And then also, we know that this bill is unconstitutional. We've had an opinion on it already, and that is chiefly because it does not offer compensation. I want to ask the ANC Youth League that, are you saying that you would support nationalization of the bank and the shareholders being paid for depriving them of their ownership? If you can just clarify that. And then also to the Treasury, just generally, this is not a new matter. It came up before when Governor Marcus was the governor, and there were some rogue shareholders who tried to have a hostile attempt to take over to the bank, whatever. But frankly, that is why the law was subsequently changed to make a more sensible arrangement. Around that time, I actually went to London and I had a discussion with the Bank of England about the history of the nationalization of their bank in 1936. And the bottom line was that they had to pay an enormous amount of compensation to the shareholders. In fact, they gave them debt at the time, but they couldn't afford to pay it. And then eventually settled the final debt. I think it was in 2015. That was about £35 million that was still outstanding. So it was an enormous amount of money. But what I want to ask the Treasury is that, are you saying that one of the key risks here is that our opinion obviously is that it's unconstitutional, but let's say this bill did in fact get passed and somehow the shareholders were then deprived of their ownership of the shares and they then sued government and won, that the risk then to the, never mind the stability of our economy in terms of international sentiment, but also the cost implications possibly would run into billions of rands that shareholders would need to be compensated with, as was the case in the Bank of England. And also, I just wanted to comment also that I don't think this matter's got anything to do with race whatsoever. It's actually got to do with the governance of the bank and the stability of the South African economy. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Dr. George and Honorable Shibambu. Alan, are there other members who are raising their hands? Hello, Alan.
Yes, Chair, Mr. Skosana, raising his hand.
Okay. Mhlonishwa Skosana.
Ngiyathokoza Hlalo. Thokoza khulu kwamambala. Begodwa ngilotshisa amalunga ahloniphekileko nama-institutions and structures asivakatsheleko. I'm not going to put my view on this matter as per the norm, as you indicated, the Honorable Chair, but I'm just going to ask questions. And I think at the right time, when as members of this committee, I think considers this bill, I think I will then put my own personal view on the matter. But for now, I'm just going to ask questions. To the Institute of Race Relations, Mr. Andrews, I think he indicated that the South African Reserve Bank is one of the few best run institutions in this country. In fact, he said it's a diamond, and he further indicated that it's doing very well under the current leadership of the governor, Mr. Lefetsa Kganyako. But what I want to find out from him is that don't he think that the positive things that he's raising about the Reserve Bank currently, is it's because of the good leadership and the good management as opposed to the issue of ownership? Don't he think that the other institutions, like other state-owned entities that have got challenges, is it because of the leadership and the management as opposed to the issue of ownership, that we've got challenges with other state-owned entities because they are state-owned, or because of the poor management or poor leadership that we have in those entities or in those institutions? Because I think we need to also draw the line to say, where we've got challenges, is it because of ownership or is it because of the management and the leadership that we have there? So I'd like to get that from him. The second question would go to the ANC Youth League Crisis Committee, Comrade Silamlet. Well, in reference to what Mr. Andres raised, that was in the presentation of the Institute of Race Relations, Mr. Andres says that the question of who owns the central bank is of marginal importance because it seems to have little impact on the financial stability. In essence, I think he's trying to say that the shareholders, the private shareholders in the Reserve Bank, they've got very limited role or influence in the running of the central bank. And I think he also went further, I think, to quote the governor, Mr. Lefetsa Kganyako, where the governor says that in actual fact, there's no private, according to the governor, he says there's no private ownership of the Reserve Bank, though there are private shareholders, but they don't own the Reserve Bank. So I want to get the views of the Youth League in relation to these issues that have been raised by Mr. Andres, and also quoting the current governor of the Reserve Bank in saying that though there are private shareholders in the Reserve Bank, but they don't necessarily own the Reserve Bank. But also the last question to also Comrade Salamlele, what is his view on the issue of the alleged high cost that will be associated with the changing of the shareholding of the central bank as per the presentation of Mr. Moinmat from the National Treasury? Thank you very much, Chair.
Siyathokoza mhlonishwa Sikhosana. And also, at least it looks like now you can even put your video on. So, extendule a broadband lapha eSiyabuso because you were struggling all along.
So, I'm in Cape Town.
Oh, I thought you are at Siyabuso where you struggle with connectivity. Thanks. Alan, are there other members who would like to make ask clarity seeking questions?
No, Chair, no other members, and there's nothing on the chat either.
Okay. Can we get the stakeholders to fill the questions asked by honorable members? Can we start with the Crisis Committee, Youth League? Then we'll come to National Treasury, and then Institute of Race Relations.
Yeah, thank you, Honorable Chair. I will start with the question. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
I'll start with the question of cost, Chair. Chair, when you expropriate in the public interest, you are supposed to, it is well-established norm that you pay reasonable compensation if you wanted to pay compensation. Reasonable compensation. Because you are doing that in the public interest. So suppose, Chair, you want to build a settlement. You want to build a settlement. And because you want to build a settlement, property developers buy the land and want to sell it to you back at very, very exorbitant cost. What do you do with that? You expropriate the land and pay reasonable compensation if you are so willing. But because it's in the public interest, compensation in the public interest is allowed. And it has been done even outside the country. The Marshall Plan was largely based on expropriation. And I wanted to hear anybody saying that it did not happen. The New Deal was based on expropriation. For to build its energy capacity, to build infrastructure, the federal government of the United States had to expropriate. They had to do that. It is well-established norm in the world. The other question, I did not capture it very well. If it could be resurfaced, rephrased. Hello?
Which question? Asked by who?
The first, by Honorable Sikhosana.
Oh, Mhlonishwa, can you restate your question?
The very first question.
No. Okay, thank you very much, Chair. No, I'm saying in terms of the presentation of Mr. Andres from the Institute of Race Relations, he says that the question of who owns the central bank is of marginal importance because it seems to have very little impact on financial stability. Now, in essence, it means that the shareholders of the private shareholders of the central bank, they've got a very limited role or influence in the running of the central bank. So I'm saying, what is your view on that? And okay. Further, I think quoted the governor, Mr. Lesetsha Khanya, when the governor says that there's no private, according to the governor, he says, in actual fact, there's no private ownership of the Reserve Bank, though there are private shareholders, but they don't necessarily own the bank. So what is your view on that?
I think Mr. Andres knows that he's either a liar or is commenting on things he knows very little about. Because the Reserve Bank Act, the primary act that we are discussing, states the influence of the
shareholder of the reserve of an annual general meeting.
Hello. Mute your video. Your sound is getting poorer.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you now.
I am saying, honorable members, that Mr. Andres knows that he's lying, or is either commenting on matters he knows nothing about, if he's not lying. Because the Reserve Bank, by the primary act that is being discussed here, the Reserve Bank shareholders elect 7 out of 14. That is, you can refer, Honorable Chair, to section 4 of the Primary Act. You can refer to that section. So Mr. Andres is lying, or is either commenting on things he knows nothing about. So we honorable members are encouraged not to listen to lies, because honorable members have taken oath of office to serve the people of the Republic of South Africa. So Mr. Andres is lying. Mr. Andres is merely serving his interest. Now, what the governor said is not true, because we are hereby referring to that section in particular. There are many other sections that comes after that we have also commented about. But just refer to section 4 of the South African Reserve Bank Act. And that is Act number... That is Act number 90 of 1989, as amended. That is the act we are discussing. That is what Mr. Andres is either having no knowledge of and not even choosing to comment on, or is lying to the people of the Republic of South Africa and to the Parliament of the Republic. So I suppose I answered the question. Thank you.
Thanks. Now it will be an opportunity for National Treasury, then after that, South African Institute of Race Relations.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure that there were actually questions that I was asked, but I'll just try and deal with, I think, you know, there were comments, obviously, that were made. I mean, I think, Chair, you know, as I've said, you know, the idea of nationalizing the Saab is not a revolutionary one, and not something, you know, if we were to start afresh and starting to create a reserve bank, you know, we probably would have started there like most countries. I think the issue is, how do you move, you know, is it a costless exercise to move towards that? And what I'm trying to show in my presentation is there's almost very little benefit at, you know, just to do that, because in terms of the actual policies of the staff, the private sector or the private shareholders have zero influence. Secondly, that if you, in terms of challenges, yes, we may well win and just, a court may rule that we only have to pay the nominal value and we can force people. But if there are shareholders who hold out, what do they get paid? And if you then decide to expropriate and they take us through the BITs, none of us can say that the courts will rule in our favor. We don't know what it will cost. Now, let's be generous and say it will still not be very expensive, okay? It could cost billions and billions, we don't know, or it could cost nothing more than the 20 million that we have. But it will take years to resolve. These things will take, you know, 3 to 5 years or more, I don't know, to resolve. And in all that time, there'll be even more uncertainty that we generate. So look at the cost of whatever decision that comes will take so long. And do we need that added uncertainty? And the point that I've tried to make is it's very hard to cause uncertainty in that come from perceptions, because as it is, I think any left-leaning government, if you're a Labour Party in the UK, and if they were to move on nationalisation, it's seen in a particular way. Whereas if it's a very conservative party that does it, it's seen in another way. So let's not be blind to those implications. It will generate fears, and there is a land debate that's going on, as we're all aware, that people will say, will expropriation stop at land? Will it go further to financial assets? And in a way, even if we had a law to say that we won't do it, people will not believe us because you can always change the law. So it does introduce uncertainty, Chair. And yes, it's hard to cost. Nobody knows that for certain. I'm not coming here to say this will definitely happen, but we will generate more uncertainty for very, very little or no benefit at all. I think the second point that I tried to make is in the context of capture, this becomes a further issue for us in our country to address, that people, many will assume, or again, it's a perception, even if it's the wrong perception, the fact that people have perception that it will lead to more corruption, to state capture, really, there's no benefit to it. It does make things worse. So those are the issues that I think come up. I think I've answered most of the comments. I'm not sure if I answered Mr. George's comment. He made some reference to asking the Treasury, but it wasn't clear what the question was.
Okay. No, you have responded to the questions. Leave comments aside. We'll deal with those when we go to the next session of responses. South African Institute of Race Relations, over to you to respond.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to briefly respond to Mr. Selamolela first before I answer the Honourable Skoskana's question. So I think Mr. Selamolela is still quite a young person and maybe hasn't had time to do the proper research. It seems that he missed the 2010 amendment of the Reserve Bank Act, in which the size of the board was increased to 15 members, of which only 7 are elected by the private shareholders. In other words, the private shareholders are only able to influence the minority of the board members of the South African Reserve Bank, and therefore their influence really is very, very strongly constrained. They do not call the shots at the bank. And I think this is quite a good point that Honorable Skoszana raised, which is that if the presence or absence of private shareholders is only of marginal importance, then why should anybody be opposed to removing them, in other words, nationalizing the Reserve Bank, or why should anybody support having them there? If it doesn't matter much either way, then why is this even an issue that we're talking about? But I think it is an issue, and I'd like to sort of also direct the Honorable Skoszana and also Mr. Selamolela to some of the sources which are referenced in my submission, which is the second edition of Rosa Lastra's book, International Financial and Monetary Law, which explains that the shareholding, so who owns the central bank, actually doesn't have much influence on the financial stability of the country. I also point you to Populism and Central Bank Independence by Charles Goodhart and Rosa Lastra, published in the Open Economics Review. And I also point you to a book called Unelected Power, The Quest for Legitimacy in Central Banking and the Regulatory State by Paul Tucker. And I think that reading these books and publications will certainly help to clarify some of these issues that seem unclear in Mr. Selamolela's mind. Getting back to the point of why it matters whether you now nationalize the Reserve Bank or not, if the private shareholders don't have much influence, the thing is that what you've got here, to use another analogy, in the Reserve Bank which we've got is something like a Rolls Royce. And maybe some of the honorable members have the pleasure of owning a Rolls Royce, which is very, very nice. It works very, very well. But if you start fiddling with it and you start taking parts out and replacing them with other parts, then it probably won't work as nicely. And this is the case here with the private shareholders. I think the role they play in actual fact is very small. It was very strongly constrained through the 2010 amendment to the Act. But their presence, I think, does have an influence on the thinking and on the way the Reserve Bank is run, even if it is not tangible, even if it is not really concrete. And this influence, I think, in turn, influences the perception of the Reserve Bank. as Mr. Mamoniat has pointed out so very clearly. And what is that issue here is if I show you one of these here, one of these things, a bill of money, what is that? This is a tangible object, but the tangible object has no value. It is worthless by itself. The paper doesn't have value. What has value is the imagined reality that we create around that object. So we construct something, which is the idea of money, which is the idea if I give this to somebody, they will give me something in return. And this is a shared imagination, a visualization of meaning. And central bank independence is also one of those imagined realities. So it is something that people agree to as a matter of convention when they think about central banks. They say, yes, this central bank that I'm looking at, like the Saab, is an independent central bank. And therefore, it is a respected central bank and one that does its job well, one that's able to maintain monetary stability, for example. If you start messing with the governance structure that surrounds this institution by changing the law, by nationalizing the private shareholders, by running roughshod over their rights, whatever they might be, then you are putting in doubt the imagined reality. And you're casting a question mark over the independence of the Reserve Bank. And I think that is exactly the point that Mr. Mamoniat was raising earlier. You start fiddling with these things, and even though the thing itself isn't so important, the fiddling itself sends a message, and it damages the institution, and that is the great risk that we see. As for the points that were made earlier on about race playing a role in this, it really doesn't, and it really shouldn't. The important thing is that the institutions must be well run, and that is, I think, what all of us have an interest in, that institutions be well run. And we have a well-run institution here. We should not change it, because then it will become worse, and that would be a bad outcome. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, John, from the Institute of Race Relations. Let me indicate, honorable members and our stakeholders, this is a meeting of the Portfolio Committee, of the Standing Committee Finance. Today, it was a session where we are conducting public hearings. So what we should avoid doing is to have a situation where stakeholders begin to respond to each other, because I'm looking at the chat box. Mr. Zlamlela say something, I want to respond. John also wants to respond. Then it becomes a meeting of stakeholders, and it will lose their meaning. So we can create another platform for stakeholders to engage somewhere else. But as this is a parliamentary session, what we do, you present, and then it is us, members of parliament, who ask clarity seeking questions on the presenters. From there, I have to conclude. Unless there's any other member before I move towards the conclusion and closure and give way forward.
No, Chair, nobody else.
Okay. What will happen, as I've indicated, now that we have received written and oral submissions, the legal division, because unlike a bill coming from a minister, the legal division which assists Mr. Malima, who has tabled this bill, will have to probably sit with Mr. Malima and then look at responses to all these submissions. So we'll create a day and time for the responses. Is Nolu Thando here from a legal division?
Yes, Chair, I am here.
Okay. What I will also request from you, I will request that you also do some bit of socio-economic impact assessment. The research division of parliament will assist you, so that it should not look like we have just rushed to pass a bill without going through all those necessary procedures. Of course, if it has come through the minister, the relevant department will have done a socio-economic impact, present the bill to the cluster, then passes the bill and then takes it to cabinet through the leader of governance, submit the bills to the speaker, and then the speaker refers the bills to committees. So if by the time you come back, Nolutando, how you engage Mr. Malima is something else between yourselves. You can get parliamentary division to assist you dealing with this aspect, so that when somebody raises it at a future stage, it should not be like we have just ignored it. Let it come from the authority and the parliamentary research office can do a lot of work in this regard. It will also include, if you can also do some work on the ownership and the shareholding, so that all these issues that have been raised have to be clarified and enlist the services of experts in Parliament. And then by the time you come back representing Mr. Malima, you will have dealt with all these issues, because they have to be included in the report, so that we don't leave any stone unturned. What decision will be taken ultimately is something else. So let's close all the loopholes in regard to the processing of a bill through the channels of the executive. Should almost be the same with processing the bill through the private members bill process. I think that's quite important. So that's that, honorable members. Thanks very much. Thanks very much to the stakeholders. And also thanks very much to the officials from government, treasury, and parliament. Are there announcements, Alan, before we adjourn the meeting?
No announcements, Chair, but just that the next committee meeting is Tuesday next week.
Okay. So the announcement that we have is the next meeting on Tuesday. Thanks, honorable members. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Chair.